Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, you can register for the Here We Still Stand regional event. What if I told you there were only, well, at the time this releases, there are less than 30 tickets left for that. There's less than 30. That's what I'm telling you. So if you want to go to that event, you got to grab that ticket because soon there'll be zero tickets for that. That is going to happen. And so there's a link in the show notes. You can click on that, get registered for that two-day event, or you can go over to 1517.org and find that event and register. While you're registering for that event, make sure you sign up for an academy class. Have you taken Chad Bird's Christ in the Old Testament academy class? If you haven't, why not? It's free. You can go through Christ in the Old Testament with Chad, or maybe you're like, but I listen to this podcast, Dan. I think I got longer than that academy is worth of Christ in the Old Testament. Well, fair enough. But have you taken the Gospel according to Luke, the Life of Christ, with myself and Eric Sorensen? Have you taken that? You might need to do that. Maybe you're like, I don't need more of Dan in my life. That's the thing. 40 minutes a week is about all I can handle. Fair enough. But have you considered Christianity America with Dr. Daniel Invoris and get some history going? Or maybe the Augsburg Confession with Scott Keith? Or maybe Vocation with Michael Berg? That'd be a good one. You want to get some meaning extracted from your day-to-day life and learn about the doctrine of vocation with Michael Berg? I think you get the point. There's a lot of academies over there that you could sign up for. They're all free. So go and look at the long list of them and see if there's one that you could take. I think that you would find it really edifying. All right, Chad, we are in 2 Kings chapter 23, and we are going to get into Josiah's reform. So we got a little sneak peek at Josiah. Actually, kind of get the best feel for kind of who Josiah is in that sort of pre-reform thing. So Josiah having the book of the law is discovered, and it's read in his presence, and this has a profound impact on him, and he says, this sounds like we're in deep, deep trouble. It doesn't sound like we've been doing any of this stuff. It sounds like we've been doing all the things that this thing tells us not to do and none of the things this tells us to do. So I think we have found ourselves in a bad situation. Better go talk to this prophetess and see if she agrees. She totally agrees with Josiah on this. She confirms his worst fears. Like, indeed, we're going to have some judgment coming in the near future. But tells him, hey, you know what? God appreciates the heart that you have. He appreciates the humbleness in which you hear this word. And this wrath and judgment is not going to come in your life, and Josiah's life will be short, but it won't come in that life. And he doesn't then just walk away and say, okay, good, I'm going to live out my days and I won't have to endure the wrath of the Lord. But instead, we get into this chapter where he is going to start doing some what John the Baptist would call making the path straight.
Yeah, make the path straight, bring the mountains down, burn the Asherim.
Yeah.
kill the false priest. I mean, yeah, he's going to take a broom. He's going to do a little sweeping here. Actually, a lot of sweeping. There's going to be some, I guess, more reformation as far as like the religious reformation that we've seen up to this point. I mean, we've had some cleanups that have taken place, but we have not seen the kind of cleanups that are about to take place here. So much so that he's not only going to, as it were, just kind of trash all the idols, but he's going to make sure that even the stuff they were made out of can't be used again. He's going to desecrate. So there's going to be destruction and desolation. He's going to make sure that all these things that have been used before cannot be used again because they're going to be desecrated by, well, mostly by human bones. So we'll get to that in just a minute. But yeah, just kind of to keep in mind too, if you're just listening and have not like actually looked in your Bible or your Bible app to kind of see where we're at, we're close to the end of 2 Kings. Now, this is chapter 23, and there's only 25 chapters in 2 Kings. So we are very near the end. And just to kind of give you an idea as to how close we are, not just the end of the book, but to the end of this segment of Israel's history, which is going to end with the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem and the Babylonian captivity. So when Josiah ends his reign, when he dies, then Israel, Judah, has basically two decades left. So that's how close we are. I mean, like, so this isn't like, oh yeah, a couple hundred more years, Babylonians are going to come in and demolish everything, tear down the temple, take everybody to into exile. No, this is like right on the cusp of that destruction. In fact, it will be. So there's going to be four kings after Josiah. Three of those are his sons, and one of those is a grandson. And it will be the final king, Zedekiah, who is the youngest son of Josiah. He will be the final king of the Southern Kingdom.
Yeah,
so
you might get the idea.
I'd say we're at the end here.
You might, and that might make you realize that some of these kings aren't kings for a very, very long time. These are not long reigns. So I mean, when Josiah hears that the wrath of God is not going to visit Judah in his days, it does come very quickly after his days. You do get the feeling that God is waiting for his servant Josiah to be done, and then I mean, if a day is as 1,000 years and 1,000 years is a day to the Lord, I mean, I don't know what 2 decades is, but it's not a very long time.
No. Blink of an eye. So we finished up chapter 22 of 2 Kings with them bringing back word to the king from the prophetess Huldah. So she's told him what's going to happen, that wrath will still be coming, but that Josiah will be gathered to his fathers. So they bring back that word, and the king decides, very beginning of 2 Kings 23, that in the time that he has, he's going to make sure and make the most of it. And so he gathers everybody together. He sends out messengers, and they start pulling people into Jerusalem. All the elders of Judah and Jerusalem, they get together with him. And then the king goes up to the temple, to the house of the Lord, and he takes with him all the men of Judah and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the priests and the prophets and all the people, both small and great. So you get the image here that all of Jerusalem and this whole surrounding area is a stir. Everybody's talking about what's happening. So there's going to be this mass gathering that takes place at the temple. So they all get together. And when they did, he opened up this scroll that was found, the Book of the Covenant, and he read it. He read it in their hearing, all the words of the Book of the Covenant that had been found in the house of the Lord. I kind of picture, you know, they have some sort of stand, perhaps, that he's on, and everybody's crammed in there, like at a concert or something like that, shoulder to shoulder, and they're listening as this book is read to them. And the impact of that is going to be basically that this book stands as a critique against all the stuff that's around them. Because it was, as we're going to hear in just a minute, this house of the Lord, the temple that they're in, is just packed. I mean, packed with idols of all kinds. I mean, they got them in the storerooms. They got them in the courts. They got them all over the place. So he reads it. And while this is happening, the king is standing by a pillar. Now, that's a detail that may or may not ring a bell with you, but if you go back to 2 Kings chapter 11, this is right after. You remember the story of Queen Athaliah, the one who tried to murder all the possible heirs to the throne, and she took over in the Southern Kingdom, and for a few years she was the one who was the reigning monarch. But there was a child king, Jehoash, who was secretly taken away, and when he was just a kid, they brought him out. And then Athaliah, you know, hollers treason, treason when she's put to death. Well, when all that was going on back in 2 Kings 11, we read that the king, that is this child king, Jehoash, was standing by the pillar according to the custom. And then when all this was going on, after all this, they made a covenant with the Lord. So evidently this pillar was like the place where the king stood. This is like his royal position. Happened back in 2 Kings 11. Is happening now again in 2 Kings chapter 23. So he stands by the pillar, and they make a covenant, a pact with the Lord, or before the Lord, to walk after the Lord, to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all his heart and all his soul. That's the language of the Shema from Deuteronomy 6. All your heart and all your soul and all your might. So to do that, and to perform the words of this covenant that were written in the book. So the, and then just in case you get the idea that this was just, you know, what the king wanted, it says that all the people join in the covenant with him. So this is to be a united front against the idolatry that has polluted the temple and polluted all of Jerusalem. So verse 4 says that to carry this out, the king is going to issue some commands. It says that he issued a command to, first of all, the high priest, a guy named Hilkiah. We've heard about him earlier in connection with the finding of this book of the Torah. So the king commands Hilkiah, the high priest, and the priest of the second order, and the keepers of the thresholds. All these people are part of the temple servants, that they are to bring out of the temple all the vessels made for Baal and for Asherah, those two divine lovers that were kind of the popular Canaanite deities, Baal and then his consort Asherah. So vessels made for them and for all the host of heaven. So this kind of this astral worship that was very common in Canaanite religion and really all over the ancient Near East. So they've got all these vessels that were made for the god Baal, the goddess Asherah, and then the astral deities. And what are they going to do with them? Well, he said, we're told that he took them outside Jerusalem to the fields of the Kidron. I'm assuming this is just part of the Kidron Valley, which is right there beside Jerusalem. You cross the Kidron Valley, you leave the temple going east, go out the Eastern Gate, and then you go down the Kidron Valley, and then you go up the Mount of Olives. So this is on the eastern side of Jerusalem, eastern side of the temple. And they take them there, and they burned them. And one of the reasons they burned them is not just to destroy them, but this is exactly what Moses did with the golden calf back in the day. So in Exodus 32:20, we read that Moses took the calf that they had made and burned it with fire and ground it to powder. And then he scattered it on the water and made the people of Israel drink it. And this is exactly, by the way, so they just heard from the book of the law, which is presumably Deuteronomy. And in Deuteronomy 12, we read that when the Israelites get to the promised land and they conquer it from the Canaanites and the Perizzites and Amorites and everybody else, God says, you shall tear down their altars and dash in pieces their pillars and burn their Asherim with fire. So, Josiah is doing nothing more than what Moses had already done by way of example and by what Deuteronomy said was to be done. So he burns them outside Jerusalem. Now, there's a little detail that's added here too that we're going to come back to. But he said, we're told that he carried their ashes, the ashes from burning of these deities, to Bethel. And we will come back to that. But keep in mind that Dan, the city of Dan in the north, and the city of Bethel in the south, those are the two places where Jeroboam, who made Israel to sin, set up those two golden calves.
Yeah. Yeah,
so we'll come back to Bethel in a minute.
Yeah, I mean, it's not for no reason that you take something outside of Jerusalem and burn it, right? So you don't just like go to wherever it is and then light it up. There's a symbolic move here where you remove the thing and then destroy it. So both of these, you have a double symbolism here, right? Where we're not going to destroy it in the city, is we want the people to see that this is being removed from our presence, right? So this is no longer welcome here.
Yeah, that is the symbolism. So you take the unclean thing and you don't, as it were, start a fire in the courts of the temple and burn it there. No, you're going to take it outside the city. It's being removed from the sacred precincts of the city because it is unclean. And it's to be taken to the Kidron Valley, and there it's destroyed. There it's burned with fire. And the ashes of this then are going to be used later, but they're going to be taken up to when they're taken up to Bethel.
It seems that part of that, I mean, obviously the symbolism is like, hey, remove the unclean thing from your midst and this kind of thing. There's also, you don't want this heap of, you don't want to light something on fire, have this heap of ashes where people might be tempted to, like, this is where the thing was. Here, the ashes are floating. It's almost as though you don't want to destroy it there, lest any remnant of it remain. So you take the whole thing out and then destroy it, because I don't want like a I don't want just so much as a little ash floating around the air of Jerusalem of this thing. We got to take it outside and destroy it.
Yeah, or somebody pick out some of the ashes and put them in some little receptacle, and
yeah,
that in itself becomes an idol to them. Yeah, these are the ashes of the goddess's pole or something that used to be precious to me. You know, people do that.
Yeah.
This is not far-fetched whatsoever. People would certainly do something along those lines. All right, so he's taking care of all these vessels dedicated to Baal Asherah and the host of heaven. Takes them out, destroys them, burns them. But he also has to deal with not just these vessels, but also the priest, the people who were making offerings to those. And that's what happens in verse 5. He deposed is the way that the ESV translates this. The Hebrew verb is the same verb from which we get Shabbat or the Sabbath. So this is what's called a hifil form of that verb, which to Shabbat is to rest, and to a hifil in Hebrew is usually causative. So cause to rest. In this sense, it's to stop or discontinue. So he's basically putting a stop to the work of these priests. And so depose is a good translation of that. He's removing them, deposing them, the ones that the kings of Judah had ordained to do what? To make offerings in the high places at the city of Judah and around Jerusalem. Those who burn incense to Baal, and then we have mention of the astral deities again, to the sun and the moon and the constellations and all the host of heaven. By the way, I'm sure we talked about this way back in Genesis, but there's a pretty good argument to be made that when Genesis 1 is describing the creation and it gets to mentioning the stars, it's almost like an aside. God made everything. Oh, yeah, he made the stars, too. And the reason is because, of course, in the ancient world, the stars were revered. They were worshipped. So that's Genesis 1's kind of very subtle downplaying of the importance of the stars, because their importance was upplayed in the religions of the ancient Near East. So he deposes the priests, everybody who had been making these offerings, burning incense to Baal and the astral deities. And he also brought out from the house of the Lord the Asherah. This is probably this Asherah pole. And he took it outside Jerusalem, took it to the brook Kidron, the same place we talked about a minute ago that was called the Fields of Kidron. And he burned it there at the brook. And not only that, but he beat it to dust. So, like, not enough to just burn this thing, but, you know, give me a sledgehammer. We're going to beat this thing to dust, which again, is mimicking what happened with the golden calf. That same Hebrew phrase is used to describe what Moses did with the golden calf. He reduced it down to dust. And so that's exactly what this very Moses kind of character, Josiah, is doing. Burning it and then beating it to dust. And then get this, as if that's not enough. So we're going to destroy it. We're going to burn it. We're going to beat it to dust. Well, what else can we do with it? Well, there's one more thing that you can do with it. He cast the dust upon the graves of the common people. Now, you know from Leviticus and elsewhere too, that one of the ways in which a person or a thing or a place is defiled is by its connection with death. So death was one of the primary ways in which ritual uncleanness was contracted. So if I touch a corpse, then I catch, as it were, it's like a contagion. I catch uncleanness. So what's happening here in this situation and what we're going to see as the rest of the chapter unfolds is that death used as a way of desecrating something is becoming important. So they're taking this dust from the ashes, and now they're going to put it on the graves of the common people as a way of not just destroying them, but also providing an uncleanness to this stuff so that it can never, ever be used again for any religious purpose whatsoever.
Is there something here, too, like you have the people there, and so Josiah can't like have all the worshipers of Asherah drink the dust mixed with water, because all the other people seem to be on, everyone seems to be on board with this. Says all the people agreed. You have all these other people in the past that had been engaged in all this stuff. I can't make you drink it, but I guess I'll just throw the dust of your God all over your grave. Like, here's your God.
Here's your dead God on your dead graves.
Yeah, he can. Your God can lie in the dirt with you. Mm-hmm. It seems to be like an insult to the people who worshipped the Asherah pole and engaged in this behavior, that your God ends up in the same place that you are, which is not a very useful God.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I mean, it's a ritual act, but it's also just about as in your face an insult as you can imagine. Yeah, you know what your God is really good for? Just grave dust. That's what your God is good for. It brought death. It is death. It is dead. So we're going to lay it to rest in the place of death as well. We're going to sprinkle this stuff on the graves of the common people. So that's what they did, at least with this part. Verse 7, this is like a long list of things that they did. Next, what's it going to do with the houses of the male cult prostitutes?
Yeah, so everyone's been asking this question. This is the question on everyone's mind.
Yeah. I get emails every week.
Yes.
What's going to happen to these houses?
I like it in the Bible when you discover that something exists. You're like, well, what? Now for these things, that were, and you're like, wait a minute, the what? Like, what was happening here?
Yeah, and I mean, that's weird enough. But guess where they were? This is not the best part, but the most amazing part. Not only did you have houses of male cult prostitutes, but guess where they were located? You know, you put in your GPS, type in male cult prostitute house. It sends you right to the temple.
Yeah.
Because he broke down the houses of the male cult prostitutes, whatever that was. I don't know what houses anyway, but they were in the house of the Lord.
It's had to be like little... In my mind, I imagine you have the house of the Lord. So, like, what? I mean, the house of the Lord isn't so big that it's got like other houses in it. But maybe you have the house of the Lord, and then these are like little, rooms. They're little rooms, Bellers. Right? Yeah, it's like back then, you know, sometimes you'd have rooms divided by like curtains and that kind of stuff. What is a male cult prostitute doing? I don't know, but he might, I think I know. And, He might have a little cubicle, and it seems like these need to be broken down for sure.
Yeah, well, let's definitely take these out. So they did. They broke them down. We're not told what they did with the male cult prostitutes. But I'm guessing, judging by what they did to others, that they were no more. And then also, so you got these guys. They have women who wove hangings for the Asherah. So some sort of, maybe it was, I don't know, vestments or veils or whatever it was. These were sacred garments that were dedicated to the goddess Asherah. So you got male cult prostitutes. You got these women weaving these hangings. They're going to take care of all this. And they also, verse 8, brought out all the priests out of all the cities of Judah. And they defile the high places, these Bamoth that we've heard about over and over, defile the high places where the priest had made offerings, all the way from Geba or Geba, or however you want to say it in English, to Beersheba. You know, we're used to hearing about from Dan to Beersheba, so this is a little bit different geographical location. This city is evidently a Levitical city within a portion of the land that Joshua assigned to the tribe of Benjamin. So a little bit closer to home. So from there to Beersheba. High places all over. He broke down the high places of the gates that were at the entrance of the gate of Joshua, the governor of the city. And then we get real specific. You know, the ones which are on one's left at the gate of the city. It's almost like the author is, about, you know the ones we used to walk by every, you know, when you went through that gate, they were to the left over there. Those.
No more. So
it's a reminder, too, by the way, that high places is not necessarily a reference to how high they were, literally. A high place is just a technical term for a little worship space, a little sanctuary. And if these were at the gate, it's not like you have a hill there or something like that. It just was a ritual location where offerings were made to deities. So these are taken out. All right. Verse 9 tells us that the priest of the high places, did not come up to the altar of the Lord in Jerusalem, but they ate unleavened bread among their brothers. So the way I read that is that they were no longer allowed, because of their previous idolatrous activity, they were no longer allowed to serve Yahweh at the temple in Jerusalem, but they weren't kicked out of the priesthood. They were still allowed to eat unleavened bread among their fellow priest. So I guess some leniency there on the part of the priest. So they serve the high places. They're no longer able to do that because they're defiled, but they are still allowed to eat at least some of the bread that was connected with the temple service.
This is one thing that's interesting about Josiah. I mean, he's smashing all kinds of stuff and burning all kinds of stuff. I mean, he's getting rid of everything. But he's not doing a lot of bloodshed. I mean, in some previous sort of reform kind of stuff, like, you know, you think about, like, you know, Elijah, when him and the prophets of Baal are going to do some work. A lot of bloodshed going on there, you know. Old Joaz, you know everyone's going to die when he comes rolling through. But Josiah seems like he's got the people on board, and that's sort of enough. And he doesn't need, you know, because this could easily read, and he took all these people out and slaughtered them, and he took these male prostitutes and slaughtered them. And maybe he did. Doesn't say he didn't, but it doesn't say he did. Take these priests, they went out and got slaughtered. That's not happening. It seems that he's saying, hey, we're doing reforms, and I'm going to, if you're willing to be on board with the reforms, then I don't think that a lot of people have to die here. And now, if there was like this huge resistance, that might be different, you know, but...
Yeah, that does seem to be the case. We're not to it yet, but down here in, let's see, verse 20, there is reference to some priests who were put to death. But I think in this whole, well, I guess we'll see as we work our way through the narrative, but I think that's the only reference to any kind of executions that take place. So it's a different kind of reform. Like you said, you know, if this was Elijah, it'd be like bloodshed everywhere. He's like hacking the priest of Baal to
maybe
pieces.
And maybe the difference is like sort of the reading of the word of the Lord has this effect on the people, and they rally around that. And Josiah is willing, if you're willing to repent and to get on board, then you're gonna be okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, perhaps these priests that he do end up dead, we're not willing for that.
Yeah.
You know? And perhaps this is the difference, you know? Hey.
It's a very real possibility. I mean, it's not like you're going to have everybody on board with this reform, especially when you're attacking the, which was their means of living. And presumably, unless they were just hypocritical, they actually believed in this stuff. So,
yeah.
You know, that he didn't receive more resistance is really the shocking part of this story.
Yeah, it does make him a sort of different guy. But when you, as far as righteous kings or even prophets go, we don't have the speeches of Josiah and that kind of stuff. It makes you want to have them because you're like, how did you do this exactly, man? Like, how? It seems like you really rallied the troops. I wish I heard that rallying speech. Like, it must have been a real banger. You know, like, you got everyone on board.
Yeah, you want that, like, book on leadership that Josiah wrote.
How'd you do this exactly, dude?
Like, how'd you pull that off, yeah. What are some principles that we can incorporate in our own leadership?
How do you destroy all the religious symbols of a society and have minimal bloodshed? How do you do this? You have cracked that nut somehow.
Yeah, he did. He did very successfully. So after that... the mention of them eating unleavened bread. Now we get verse 10 to something we've touched on a couple times before, and that is kind of the low point of this idolatry that was taking place. We read that he defiled Topheth, and which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, that no one might burn his son or daughter as an offering to Molech. So there's a lot packed in that. So the place itself, Topheth, that's mentioned here in 2 Kings. It's also mentioned in Jeremiah. as this place where you have child sacrifice that's happening. And the location is important too. I don't remember if we talked about this before or not, but so the Valley of the Son of Hinnom is also referred to as the Valley of Hinnom in Hebrew. And so valley is gay, and then you have either Ben Hinnom or just gay Hinnom. So the Valley of Hinnom. Why is that important? Well, because gay Hinnom in Hebrew, the Valley of Hinnom, this valley that belonged to this guy by the name of Hinnom, that is taken directly into Greek. So gay Hinnom, Valley of Hinnom, becomes Gehenna in Greek. And then Gehenna, of course, is translated as hell in the New Testament. So it's kind of a fascinating process that takes place here. So Gehenom, the Valley of Hinnom, was originally just a place. I mean, it was a place that was right outside Jerusalem. It's a park, by the way, in modern Jerusalem, which is just crazy. You know, you drive. I didn't visit the park, but we drove by it and I looked down there and there's trees and there's benches and there's green grass and it just looks so peaceful. And you have to remind yourself when you drive by Gehenna, the Valley of Hinnom, you're like, oh, yeah, it might look pretty now, but the worst ugliness in the world took place there.
Yeah, it's centuries before. That's pretty informative. I've talked to people about this before. It's tempting to think that when maybe you're just reading the New Testament, this is where the word hell would appear. It wouldn't appear in the Old Testament at all. But even in the New Testament, when they're hearing, they're not thinking of what you're thinking at all. This is a place, but not like some place that's, you know, not like heaven and hell, not some place in some other realm or something. It's a reference to a place that really horrible things historically happened. And so it's a reference to a bad place, but it doesn't, when you hear, you know, Jesus say hell or something like that, if you read that in the Bible, your average Hebrew that's walking around, he doesn't hear that the same way you do.
Yeah, because there's this whole history behind it. And granted, it does undergo a metamorphosis, kind of a metaphorical metamorphosis, you might say, over time. But originally, it's a place, so it's a valley. Mm. And the reason it came to be associated with this, you know, the place of punishment is because in Jeremiah talks about this, how it was a place where you have child sacrifice, you have Topheth that's there. And Jeremiah says that the valley will become a place of bloodshed, like a bloodbath is going to take place there. It's probably, you know, the end of Isaiah when he talks about, you know, the worm shall not die, their fire shall not be quenched. You're going to go out and look on the dead bodies of their corpses. He's probably talking there again about this place right outside Jerusalem. So it's this valley, and you have all of this just horrendous things associated with it. It's over time becomes, you know, a bigger than life, we might say, bigger than just that valley itself. But I think maybe this is the first time that we have actually come across a reference to it as a real geographical location.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a valley. It's a valley belonging to, first of all, Hinnom, and then to Ben Hinnom, then to his sons. I've often thought, you know, poor guy. At one point in history, there was a guy named Hinnom. And little did he realize he should not have bought that valley, because it's going to be a long history behind that place. You don't want your name associated with
Valley of Death, man. That's what it is.
It is. Yeah. So he defiled it. He defiled Topheth there in the Valley of the Son of Hinnom, so that nobody else could burn their son or daughter as an offering to Molech. And some people speculate that what's going on here with Molech is, this is a reference to a pretty popular Canaanite deity, the root name of which was MLK. Most Hebrew roots have three different letters. And that what's happened here with the O and the E that's inserted there is the O and the E are also associated with the name of Shame. We talked about that before in connection with other names. So maybe the original name of Moloch or Melech or whatever it might have been, you take the vowels out of that, you insert O and E, because that's associated with shame. But whatever's going on here, that's the deity to whom the children were sacrificed. And then verse 11, so we go from child sacrifice to the horses and chariots of the sun. So he also removed, that's our same verb that we saw earlier with deposed. So he caused to rest, or he put to an end, he shabbated, he put to an end the horses that the kings of Judah had dedicated to the sun at the entrance to the house of the Lord by the chamber of some guy by the name of Nathan-Melech, which was in the precincts. And he also burned the chariots of the sun with fire.
And I think this removed and stuff language is interesting. It's not as though, because you might be like, you know, put an end to, like, oh, did he kill them all? Did he kill all these people over here and these priests and these horses and whoever? But we got words for that. Like, I mean, if you went and slaughtered them all, like, I don't think this is what it says. He just ceased the practice and removed the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's other ways this could have been described. So I think the choice of that verb is significant. And maybe this is reading too much into it, but because that is the verb for Sabbath, for Shabbat, maybe there is a little bit of a wink there that, you know, the land needs, the place needs some rest.
Yeah.
It needs rest from idolatry. And so he's causing that by removing the priest who served the high places and removing these various idolatrous objects. So here it's the horses and the chariots. Horses, we do know, as well as chariots and the sun, all those were part of the religious system of the ancient Near East. So another example of how previous kings, Manasseh in particular, had basically just went wholesale into idolatry. It's like, oh yeah, you like to worship that? Well, bring it on. You like to worship that? Well, bring it on. He's filling Jerusalem full of whatever the popular idols were of the day. And also the altars on the roof of the upper chamber of Ahaz, which the kings of Judah had made, and the altars that Manasseh had made in the two courts of the house of the Lord. Well, he pulled these down, he broke them in pieces, and he cast the dust of them into the brook Kidron. Sounds to me like the Kidron Valley is has a whole lot going on in it.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, you got a lot of burning, you got a lot of beaten stuff to find dust, you got a lot of sprinkling it in the water. It's becoming like it's the trash heap of idolatry for sure. And then he defiled the high places that were east of Jerusalem to the south of the Mount of Corruption. So that is significant because we're talking here about the Mount of Corruption is the Mount of Olives. There's a word play here. So it would have been called the Mount of Mashha, but the Mount of Destruction would be the Mount of Mashhit. So just a play on words there. So the Mount of Olives is referred to here as the Mount of Corruption. Why? Because Solomon, in generations before, Solomon, the king of Israel, had built for Ashtaroth the abomination of the Sidonians, and for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So all over the Mount of Olives, which here, again, is given the pejorative name, the Mount of Corruption, all over the Mount of Olives, east of Jerusalem, on the other side of the Kidron Valley, Solomon, to please his many wives, had built all of these various sanctuaries and altars to these deities, which, evidently, based upon what we're reading here, had just remained.
Yeah, but the shocking thing is that you've had some other guys, you know, they're few and far between, that weren't real into idolatry. But, I mean, Solomon was a while ago at this point.
Yeah, we're talking several hundred years before, and this stuff is still there. The Mount of Olives, it was which today, if you walk down the Mount of Olives toward Jerusalem, toward where the temple once was, it's covered in graves. It's a Jewish graveyard. So back in the day, though, it was full of various sanctuaries to these various gods.
Well, you're gonna see Josiah get that started, because he broke down the pillars and cut down all the stuff, and then he just decides, I'll just fill this with the bones of men.
Yeah, I think about that, but yeah, he kind of starts the cemetery, right?
Yeah,
I'm gonna. This is more not just the destruction, but the desolation. So just in case you missed it, Josiah is really kind of 100% behind this idol destruction, desolation, taking it all out. Every whatever it might be, whether it's altars on the palace roof, or whether it's cult prostitutes, or the weavings for Asherah, or the priest, or the chariots of fire, whatever, he's going to destroy it all. And he's not done. So we made it through the first 14 verses of destruction, but he's got something he needs to do at Bethel. And we'll hear more about that in the next episode. But you know, you might or might not remember that long ago, back in the days of Jeroboam, there was a man of God who said that in the future, a king would arise by the name of Josiah, and he would be the one who would bring to an end what Jeroboam had begun. So that's what we're going to hear about in verses 15 and following.
Oh, man, what a tease. Bethel cliffhanger. We're going to have to just hang there until next week. So, Chad, I will see you then.
All right, see you then.